Thanks. I will be discussing the problem of super shear earthquakes, in particular focusing on the dynamics of how they work, how they propagate on the fault, and how ruptures are allowed to move at these speeds, and connecting it to the observations that seismologists can make in the vicinity of faults, the actual ground shaking, which is measured with seismograms. This work that I did at UCSB in collaboration with Ralph Archuleta, Gene Carlson, Morgan Page, and Pascal Favreau. I'll be presenting two types of views. So if we look at an idealized fault here, I'll be presenting views of the earthquake source, for instance, slip velocity on the fault. This would be a view on the gray surface, the color scale measuring how fast the two sides of the fault are slipping relative to each other. And often we think about a seismic source as generating some type of wave field or some type of shaking in the area surrounding the fault. So this type of view would be looking down on the surface here. This is the fault. This is the actively slipping zone. And then I can make a plot, say, of how the particle or the ground is actually moving. And moving in this direction from a specification of the seismic source to the radiation is this kinematic study of ruptures. I'll be focusing also on the dynamics, where if some point breaks here, it emits elastic waves, stress waves, that transmit stresses ahead of the propagating rupture and perhaps cause it to fail or stop. So dynamics runs the other way as well, with the waves that are being emitted influencing the rupture propagation process. My problem is one of limiting rupture velocities. For the three fracture modes, modes 1, 2, and 3, I've just schematically shown the allowed and forbidden propagation velocity regimes here. There, for modes 1 and 2, there are three relevant wave speeds, the P wave or dilatational wave speed, the shear wave speed, and then since you have a broken interface behind the propagating rupture front, you also have the Rayleigh surface or interface wave speed come into the problem. For mode 3, only shear waves are excited, so there's really only one relevant wave speed. In mode 2, there are two allowed propagation regimes here, and let me explain why this is. So in order to find a self-consistent solution, you need to satisfy both the elastodynamic response of the medium. It must be consistent with some type of material behavior of the interface. And we usually think about this as either the shear or normal strength, depending on whether you're in a shear or a tensile mode, decreasing or weakening with slip or opening. So we can take a look at the elastodynamics of this, the transient elastodynamics of this, for instance, by examining the Green's function. So if we instantaneously pull the medium apart by applying some force, we can look at how the medium responds by the displacement response of it. So the arrows denote the direction of the movement of the material. So in mode 1, if you instantaneously pull it apart, waves shoot out from here. The fastest moving wave would be the P wave. And at the P wave arrival, the interface clamps closed even further, which persists up to the arrival of the Rayleigh wave speed, and then it opens. For mode 2, something interesting happens. You can see it here. You imagine exerting a force instantaneously on the upper block, puts it into compression, and that compressional wave propagates along here. The sense of slip that it creates is aligned with the direction of the force. You can imagine that just being carried by the dilatational wave. And this forward sliding persists until the arrival of the shear wave, where you get reverse slip. And then when the Rayleigh wave arrives, you again get sliding in the direction of this applied force. So what this means is that you're allowed to propagate ruptures, or you'll find steady state solutions both in this regime and this regime, but not in this forbidden regime. And so for mode 1, the limiting velocity is the Rayleigh wave speed. For mode 2, the limiting velocity is really the P wave speed with this small forbidden region in the middle there. here's the history and terminology of this, and I'm going to focus almost exclusively on mode 2, which is the predominant failure mode for large strike slip faults. This would be looking down on a vertically dipping fault. So ruptures in this regime are sub-Rayleigh, and I say typical of earthquakes. Most near-source seismograms are consistent with this. Some are not. I'll talk about those. And it's the predicted limiting velocities from early theoretical studies. So it took a little while, say the late 70s, maybe even later, before the theory was in place to explain how ruptures can propagate in the second region, the intersonic region, or the super shear region. Ruptures in this regime have been seismically observed, starting with Ralph Archuleta's study of Imperial Valley, the 1979 earthquake, and a number of events since that. I'll be discussing data and evidence from the Denali Fault earthquake in Alaska. These ruptures have also been experimentally observed. I guess we saw some examples previously, and some of the early experiments were done by Rosakis. My interest in this is the character of the radiated ground motion. This is what affects buildings and is probably a lot of the reason why we get the funding for these studies, and it's quite different between the sub-Rayleigh and the intersonic regime. To explain why it's different, I'd like to think about the rupture process in the Fourier domain, the frequency wave number domain. So we can think about some displacement field of the medium or a particle velocity field of the medium specified in terms of x, the distance along the interface, y, normal to it, and time. And we can think about taking a Fourier transform to decompose this into plane waves. These are plane P and S waves, and depending on their phase velocity along the interface, say omega over kx, the waves are both evanescent or can be either evanescent or radiating. The part that's carried out to the far field comes only from these radiating waves. So I can make a diagram sort of like this, frequency and fault parallel wave number, and plot lines of constant phase velocity along the fault. And I'll use this in my explanations here. What excites this? Well, it's the source process. So in the simplest case, we can think about the slip velocity on the fault as a function of position and time. And I like to think of it in, and this decomposition is somewhat arbitrary, but you could imagine decomposing it into a steady state rupture process here, plus some deviations from steady state. So the steady state has this dependence on space and time, which means that in the Fourier domain, I can write it like this, and you see that this fault parallel wave number, fault parallel phase velocity has to be equal to the steady state velocity. So the source, as it propagates along, is coherently exciting waves having this particular phase velocity. Deviations from steady state excite waves having all types of phase velocity, some in the radiating regime, some in the evanescent regime. But the key point here is that it's really the interference, the constructive or destructive interference of these waves that results in the signal that you see away from the fault. So the steady state part of the rupture process there represents the coherent, which is probably the low frequency portion of the source process. Sub-Rayleigh ruptures will coherently feed both evanescent P waves and evanescent S waves. Their phase velocity is down here in this evanescent regime. Intersonic ruptures, on the other hand, coherently feed evanescent P waves. The phase velocity is less than the P wave speed, but radiating S waves, since the phase velocity exceeds the shear wave speed. Let me give you an example of this. We can look for steady state solutions using a slip pulse model in either of these two regimes. This is a model that Jim Rice discussed yesterday, and in which the medium is loaded to some initial stress with a concentration at the tip of the actively slipping zone. Here, the stress breaks down linearly with distance, remains at some residual level, and then increases once the fault locks. So Ralph Archuleta and I extended this to the intersonic regime and took a look at the predicted near source ground motion, the particle velocity field that's generated by these ruptures. Here's what it looks like for a subrayleigh rupture, 0.85 times the shear wave speed. So here's the actively slipping zone. Here's the breakdown zone in red where the stress is decreasing. The arrows point the direction of motion of the medium, and the color scale tells you how fast it's moving. So you can see that slip is right lateral in the sense that this block moves that way, this one moves that way, but the predominant motion is normal to the fault, and this is what's observed in earthquakes, as I'll show you in a second, in most earthquakes. We can generate synthetic seismograms simply by picking various points here and imagining that this rupture moves past them. Here are synthetic seismograms, the fault parallel component and fault normal component of particle velocity at various distances in kilometers away from the fault. And you can see that the motion is almost entirely in the fault normal component, has this two-sided nature, the first associated with the passage of the rupture front and the second associated with the passage of the transition from slipping to locked. The motion is much smaller in amplitude on the fault parallel component. Now you see that I've plotted not one trace here, but three, corresponding to three different ruptures. They each produce identical slip introduced by the propagating pulse, but with various sized breakdown zones or process zones, so varying over an order of magnitude, yet they make almost no difference in the synthetic seismograms. This is because the waves that are being excited by this subrayleigh rupture are evanescent. The higher frequencies are very quickly attenuated with distance from the fault. There's no P wave here because it's steady state. There are dilatational component of the field and a shear component of the field, but I wouldn't say that there's a distinct P wave, say, from a hypocenter. And they look a lot like typical near-source seismograms. This is an example from the Landers earthquake. This is an example from Imperial Valley. We see a two-sided fault normal pulse and not much on the fault parallel component. You see a large degree of high-frequency motion. This would be indicative of the non-steady state part of the field. The only way you're going to get high frequencies off of the fault is if the source is exciting waves in that radiating regime. And to do that, you need to have some process that deviates from the steady state nature. More than a few kilometers from the fault, the ground motion is mostly sensitive to what I would call the kinematic parameters, what you would put into a kinematic model of the earthquake source. The rupture speed, the length of the actively slipping zone, the final slip locked in by the pulse. It's not sensitive to the extent of the breakdown zone, or how it basically doesn't depend too much on the shape of the slip velocity function. So long as you get from zero to the final slip in the right amount of time. So this explains why kinematic models have been so successful, but is bad news for those of us who would like to make estimates of this parameter. Things are quite different in the intersonic regime. This is at 1.3 times the shear wave speed. Now we're exciting radiating S waves. We're feeding those coherently and constructively. And the shear part of the field is emitted in the form of radiating S waves along a Mach front. So you see one being emitted from the leading edge of the rupture, one from the trailing edge of the rupture. These are waves that are taking off from the fault in that direction, and their sense of motion is transverse to the direction of propagation. You also see the dilatational part of the field here is very much inclined in the fault parallel direction. As we pass through square root of 2 times the shear wave speed, the sense of motion associated with these S wave reverses, it has to do with the relative sign of shear stress on the interface and the displacement field that's excited by such a source process. But it leads to a distinctive character in the radiated ground motion. You could easily pick up you could easily distinguish from a seismogram what velocity regime you're in. So I can make synthetic seismograms for such a model, and we see that. And so we see that as we move away from the fault, the portion shown in red is carried by the dilatational part of the field. The portion in blue is carried by the radiating S waves. And whereas the red part attenuates, just like it does in the sub-Rayleigh case, the blue part, the shear part, is transported without attenuation away from the fault. This is a 2D model. In reality, we have faults occurring or slipping occurring for a finite depth fault. So this type of process would be, this non-attenuation would be expected only to some distance away from the fault comparable to the depth of the source when you start seeing this three-dimensional character of the rupture. This is both good and bad. It turns out that the trace that's shown here is actually directly proportional to the slip velocity history on the fault. And like I said, it's transported without attenuation away. It's good in the sense that we have an exact record of what happened on the fault, something that we don't have for the sub-Rayleigh ruptures, but it's quite bad in the fact that, in the sense that some very high frequency ground motion and very high, large amplitudes can be transmitted to large distances away from the fault. I've shown you that both types of solutions can exist, and both of them satisfy some general features that we would like to have rupture satisfied. They both dissipate energy. They take energy from the elastic medium and dissipate it in the process zone at the crack tip. So what selects the super shear solution instead of a sub-Rayleigh solution? Andrews looked at this problem back in 1976 in two dimensions and came up with the quantitative explanation of this. And the general rule of thumb that emerges is that super shear ruptures occur on sections of the fault that are close to failure. The closer you are, the faster you're able to propagate. There's a coexistence of solutions, both sub-Rayleigh and intersonic, that have the same fracture energy, that dissipate the same amount at the crack tip, but they differ very much in the stress that's released and in their production of radiated seismic energy. For example, the sub-Rayleigh rupture produces no far field radiation in this steady state during its steady state propagation, whereas the intersonic rupture is constantly emitting radiating shear waves. So the key to understanding when you're going to get one type of solution versus the other has to deal with the transient evolution of the rupture, how the stresses are transmitted ahead of the rupture. So let me take a look at that. So let me turn again to writing the source process, say the slip velocity process, in terms of some steady state plus some deviations. So imagine that we start out with some sub-Rayleigh steady state solution. In order to excite the transition, we need to introduce some set of deviations from this steady state character that show up in the wave field here as intersonic waves that having intersonic phase velocities along the fault. And these waves need to have both sufficient amplitude and their phase needs to be correlated at sufficiently long wavelengths. What this will do is it will allow the stress ahead of the propagating rupture to rise up over some nucleation length and introduce an instability to kick it to super shear. Let me explain this in the space-time domain. I think it's a little easier to see. So let's consider how the stresses are transmitted from behind the rupture, where the stress is released, to the region that's as yet unbroken ahead of the rupture front. So here's a crack tip that's advancing to the right. We can take a look at the stress field here at say t equals zero, and imagine that it advances by some amount of time, some small amount of time, dt. The stress at a particular point falls, that's the stress drop that's powering the rupture, and because the elasticity equations are linear, we can use superposition. So we have stress drop occurring back here that's going to act as a source of waves. These waves will be, they'll shoot out from this point, overtake the crack tip. At the crack tip, they reach the locked region, and so they'll scatter off of it. The scattering process, here's the source, here's the crack tip. The scattering process introduces a complex set of wave fronts. And usually, you're not going to see these. And the reason again has to be, is because of interference. So each incremental advance of the rupture generates these waves, but the composite propagation of the rupture, the sum of the waves emitted from each point, will lead to destructive or constructive interference. And in most cases, you're not going to see these types of features. Let me show you exactly how the solution evolves for a point stress drop some distance behind, in this case, stationary crack tip. Here's the distance along the fault. Here's time. This region here is the unbroken part of the fault, and this region here is the locked part. This region is already broken, and this region is locked. So here it's free to slip. So I'll plot in the color scale here the slip velocity out in front. I'll plot the shear stress. So you can see that at t equals 0, the force is applied. Slip pulses radiate out along the fault. The fastest moving one moves at the P wave speed, and it pushes the interface in the positive direction. That wave overtakes the crack tip and exerts positive shear forces on the region ahead of the propagating rupture. So these tend to drive it faster. Most of the P waves are diffracted into S waves. You can see that feature here. I've marked it, labeled it PS. When the waves having phase velocities between the shear and the Rayleigh wave speed arrive, they actually create a negative stress, a stress in the opposite direction that tends to lock the fault. This is consistent with the explanation that you're not going to find ruptures propagating in steady state at speeds between the Rayleigh and shear wave speed. When the Rayleigh wave arrives, it again carries forces that push it in the proper direction. So let's consider a simple example of this, a steady state rupture that propagates at a constant velocity, sub-Rayleigh velocity, and introduce some type of perturbation, in this case what we call an asperity, some region of extra stress release. As the steady state rupture enters this region, we have extra stress release that generates a set of waves. Some of these, and so I show some of the wavefronts propagating out here. So this is waves coming from this point. From a later point, we also have waves being emitted. These are waves that are transmitting stresses ahead of this propagating rupture. And it's the superposition of the waves from the various points here that matters. You can see that there are certain times when you're going to get the overlap of the wave arrivals. So it's the superposition of these stresses transmitted by the waves that matter. And to complicate matters, the rupture front will change its speed in response to these waves. So we don't necessarily know the timing of how the source will release these waves. And depending on this, depending on the type of perturbation and the path of the rupture, the super shear transition can be either discontinuous or continuous. Let me give you an example from the Denali Fault earthquake. This is up in Alaska. You see the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline, the offset road here. Here's a map that the rupture initiated on a thrust fault and then propagated along a fairly straight portion of the Denali Fault. It's a strike slip fault, and about 3 kilometers north of the fault along this pipeline, there is a seismic station, pump station 10, that recorded a very interesting set of seismograms. So instead of the typical example with the large two-sided fault normal pulse like we saw in Landers and take as evidence of sub-Rayleigh ruptures, we have a source process, or we have a seismogram that has 3 pulses on the fault normal component and a much larger fault parallel to fault normal amplitude. Bill Ellsworth, Paul Spudich, and others came up with a kinematic model showing evidence for super shear ruptures. And we came up with a dynamic model to look at the same process. So the fault here evolves according to some friction law that dissipates energy at the crack tip and moves when the fault is stressed. So the objective of this is to identify some qualitative features of the seismograms that are consistent with the record that we saw. So we modeled just this portion of the rupture process. Here's a subrate. We set the stress conditions so that the rupture propagates at a sub-Rayleigh speed initially and then hits an asperity region, which kicks it super shear. here's the model. These are successive snapshots of the fault plane every 1.83 seconds. And you can see that the rupture starts out at a sub-Rayleigh speed, hits the asperity, which is to the right of this first dashed line. It's kicked super shear, and it leaves behind it a Rayleigh wave. The fault is broken, it's weakened, so it can act as a waveguide, and so you get an interface, a type of interface wave, a Rayleigh wave, propagating along it that takes the form of a slip pulse. So this goes by pump station 10, and we see the following signals. So we see the black is data, red is the synthetics. We see that the first pulse, the large fault parallel to fault normal ratio, is fit by the super shear, is generated by the super shear rupture. This later two-sided fault normal pulse is explained by the Rayleigh wave trailing it. This is very similar to what's seen in the lab. This is in Rosakis' lab, where they do experiments, photoelastic experiments on a small block triggered here. It's held in compression, and a wire's exploded to nucleate a small rupture. And so here you see snapshots where this is the P wave, this is the shear wave, and the rupture front is here. It makes a transition from sub-Rayleigh to super shear, like this, and leaves behind it a Rayleigh wave. So it's exactly what we see, I think, in the real Earth, what we see in the lab, and what's predicted by dynamics. So let me just conclude with this. There's really two questions, I think, that need to be answered. How often will these super shear earthquakes occur, and is there a minimum magnitude for them? The super shear transition is going to occur whenever the stress field ahead of a sub-Rayleigh rupture meets some nucleation criterion. The level has to be raised to far enough to trigger slip, and it needs to be raised, and slip needs to occur over large enough of an area to satisfy some nucleation criterion. So understanding this problem really requires an understanding of the type of heterogeneities, their wavelength, the characteristic wavelengths for rupture of a given magnitude, and their relative amplitude on the fault. So we need to understand this statistically. And it also suggests that the duration of super shear propagation should be related to the size of the triggering heterogeneity. So I think there's a couple unanswered questions here, but it seems very likely that if this nucleation length is quite small, I don't see why it would be a lot larger than the nucleation length for a standard earthquake, we should be seeing these ruptures at all different scales. It's just that their effects will be more pronounced the larger the magnitude of the earthquake. So let me conclude with that.
You have mentioned that this transition can be discontinuous and also continuous.
Right.
And it depends on the perturbation. I did not understand. What do you mean by continuous? In my language, continuous transition means instability of the underlying, linear instability of underlying solution, or you mean something else?
I mean continuous in the sense that the rupture front is propagating at a sub-Rayleigh speed and then moves continuously, accelerates continuously into the intersonic regime. Discontinuously would describe what often happens. Actually, I have a picture. This is a space-time plot of what happens in two dimensions for a rupture that starts here and expands bilaterally. It's discontinuous in the sense that the sub-Rayleigh rupture generates a stress peak moving ahead of the rupture at the shear wave speed that triggers slip discontinuously ahead of the rupture. And then this coalesces. I mean it in a different sense, I think, than you do.
Yeah, Eric, the last point you made was that the duration of the super shear propagation would be somehow related to the size of the heterogeneity. But previously, you had shown the existence of a steady state solution at those speeds. So why is it not that once it gets started, it's capable of propagating essentially forever as long as the conditions are met.
I think that there are two things that should be considered. One is an sort of average level of stress on the fault and whether that will emit steady state solutions of the subRayleigh or intersonic variety. And say, for instance, that you were constrained by the average stress to live in steady state pretty much at the in the subRayleigh regime. Fluctuations in that stress then could introduce perturbations that would kick the rupture to super shear speeds. And in that case, the duration of super shear propagation would be linked to the size of the triggering perturbation. For the case where the average stress is high enough to allow these intersonic solutions, then it would not be related. So I guess